if you use any AI programs, who owns the right? Are you legally allowed to use them in your films? What is E&O insurance, and will it cover anything that you use? What exactly is fair use? If you're going to pitch your scripts to networks, what considerations do you need to make in advance? Can you have just a lawyer and not an agent? These are just some of the questions that we ask Chris Edgar in our Ask an Entertainment Lawyer series. This is the Working Director Podcast, show that helps you go from emerging filmmaker to working director. As a filmmaker living in Los Angeles, I've directed over 130 projects, including 6 distributed feature films, all while helping filmmakers figure out how to level up in their careers. I do this show with one goal in mind: to help you become a working director. And if you want to join us for the live Q&A sessions and ask all of your questions, make sure you join our free private Facebook group by going to theworkingdirector.pro.
We have a question that's left over from last week's AI event. It was a big question, and none of us wanted to answer it because we thought it should come from a lawyer, which is basically, if we're using AI assets, so I go into a software program and I decide to, you know, I say I need a girl with flower hair and she's on the moon, and it gives me this image, and then I use that image. Do I own that image? Can I be sued for using that image? Am I allowed to use it commercially? What, as far as AI goes and protecting ourselves, what do we need to do, Chris Edgar?
You may not be super happy to hear this answer, but right now that's an issue that's being worked out in the courts. If the question is whether you're going to be liable for copyright infringement if you use AI-generated images in the film, the short answer is that we don't know because, there are many lawsuits that are working their way through the courts right now that are on this very subject. So briefly, the plaintiffs in these copyright lawsuits are saying two things. First, they say that the makers of software like Midjourney or Stable Diffusion copied their artistic work because they trained the AI software using these artists' photos and paintings and so on. And it remains to be seen whether that is copying or copyright infringement for the purposes of U.S. law. Second, the people who are filing these lawsuits say that there are certain images that are generated by AI software that are infringing because they're overly similar to the artist's work. Unfortunately, it's just kind of a matter of, the court system not keeping pace with technological progress. But hopefully we're going to get some more concrete answers to this question soon. Now, all that being said, as a practical matter, if you're making a low-budget indie film, the likelihood that an artist whose work was used to train Midjourney or Stable Diffusion or something like that is going to come after you for copyright infringement, I think, is very low, because they and their attorneys are not going to see you as a huge potential source of money. It's really the big studios that need to be more concerned about this if they're using AI-generated images in their films, because plaintiffs' lawyers are going to essentially see them as deep pockets. So I know that that's not a completely satisfying answer, but hopefully it provides some sort of clarity.
Well, I think it's great because my mind is, at this point, just don't do it. Now, if it's for like pitch decks and sizzle reels, things that you're not making money on, I think it's a little easier. Like for the film Chris and I are currently putting together pitch deck for a feature film, we're using AI-generated images because it looks really cool in the pitch deck, but no one's ever going to see it, so it doesn't matter.
And actually, that brings up one issue that I should raise, which is that you've all heard of this concept of fair use. And then that's like a defense to copyright infringement. Like, even if I would otherwise be liable for copyright infringement, what I did was fair use. And there are 4 factors that courts consider in deciding whether the use of a copyrighted work was considered fair use. One of the issues that courts will consider is whether there was some sort of commercial benefit to the person who was using the work. So that if you were doing this as part of a nonprofit or educational work, or like Jen said, you're just submitting it to a couple of people as part of a pitch deck, then you're less likely to be held liable for that than if you put this in a movie that's going to have a big theatrical run.
Perlman asks, what are those AI programs again for the pitch deck images? We've been using Midjourney for our, it makes beautiful, gorgeous images. I also am big on Canva because Canva has this magic edit. So you basically could put in, say, your actual actor, and like scrub out their clothing and say, put them in military outfit, and it'll put it, it's mind-blowing how good it is. I think this is a question Jody has, is kind of, it's basically along the lines of what you just talked about, but we'll ask it specifically. I'm editing a documentary about a historical figure from the middle 1900s who's influenced a lot of people's lives. I want to show 4 quick shots, off the computer screen of YouTube and TikTok influencers to contrast current versus past influencers. Is that fair use?
I think that is a good example of fair use, yes, because it's what's called transformative. In other words, you're not just showing the clips of the influencers on TikTok with no context. You're using them to show this sort of historical trend. So in other words, you're adding an element to them. And I'm going to speak in kind of abstract terms when talking about fair use, because it is this kind of, you know, wishy-washy inquiry where you consider all the four factors, but you don't know which one is given the most weight or whatever. But just to put it in the most concrete possible terms, if you are adding some sort of expressive element that didn't exist in the TikTok reels to begin with, like you're using them to make a historical comparison, for instance, then that is more likely to be considered fair use. And that's a good example of how you can use an otherwise copyrighted video clip or photo in your documentary.
Does it make sense for Jody to try to go to those influencers on TikTok and get a release? Or is it better to just like not ask forgiveness later kind of thing?
Well, if you're producing an independent documentary, then I think it's unlikely that the TikTok influencers are going to want to come after you. Like, it's not going to be a situation where you ask them and they say, okay, that'll be $10,000. And then you go off and say, well, no, that's too rich for my blood. I'm going to use the clip anyway. And then they sue you because it's, again, not a massive budget production where whatever lawyer is representing them is going to see you as, you know, a potentially rich target. So I wouldn't worry about it that much if we're talking about an indie documentary that's not going to be all over Netflix and HBO and so forth. I would always say that as a general matter, it's better to try to get a license. But if that's financially impossible for whatever reason, like if you're working on a no budget production or something like that, then yeah, I would take into account these practical factors, like how much money is there in the pot currently in terms of the budget and how much money is realistically likely to be made. Because those are factors that whoever is considering suing you is going to think about.
Jody just says, if it matters, we're not using audio from the clips, just a few 3 to 4 second shots as examples of current influencers.
That's good from a fair use perspective as well, because the fair use inquiry also takes into account how long the clip is relative to the length of the entire film. And of course, that means if you had a short film that was only, you know, 5 minutes or something like that, and you used a 4 second clip, then the clip would be, you'd be less likely to be found to have engaged in fair use than if we're talking about a feature film with a 4 second clip. But either way, the 4 second clip with no audio, I think that works in your favor for the purposes of fair use.
When it comes to contracts like fair use and licensing people's work and everything that revolves around that, is that something that FilmTracks will be able to do when it's live?
Yeah, and FilmTracks is, it's both the name of my video channel, which is live, where I talk about subjects like this. I have videos on copyright and fair use and AI and so forth. And there's also an application called FilmTracks that's currently in production that's going to be about allowing people to enter data into a form like a Google form. And then essentially that will spit out one of the typical types of contracts that you need as an indie filmmaker, like a talent agreement, or a license agreement, location agreement, or something like that. So the idea is to make this process of creating contracts more streamlined and not require you to either pay a lawyer an hourly rate to do something that's a relatively basic job, or to just kind of find an agreement on Google that has nothing to do with the entertainment business and hope for the best.
Lucky says, can you shoot in a public place like Times Square with all the logos in view in the sides and background of the shot and not get properly released? Disney, McDonald's, etc.
So if we're talking about shooting in a public place, then generally speaking, people who are walking around in public don't have an expectation of privacy, like you were saying. And so you don't need to get releases from everyone who you shoot who's walking down a street if you're just doing some sort of establishing shot. Now, specifically, I think that was one of your questions, and the other one is specifically on the issue of logos. Then generally speaking, that should be fine because you're not filming in a way that would suggest that you have some sort of affiliation with the businesses that use those logos. So you're not claiming to make a McDonald's commercial or that your movie was paid for by McDonald's or something like that. If you were doing that, then you would run into a potential trademark infringement problem. But for McDonald's or Nike or whoever to show trademark infringement, they have to show what's called the likelihood of confusion, which means that there's the reasonable person or the average person looking at that shot in the film might be confused as to whether you have some sort of affiliation with McDonald's or Nike. In the context of this kind of establishing shot, I would say that there's not really a risk of that. A lot of people, this is a really important question for indie filmmakers who often say, oh no, there's someone who walked with you know, wearing a Nike shoe through this shot. Nike's going to sue me. I'm going to be ruined. Usually you don't have to worry about that. So hopefully that's a load off of somebody's mind.
So I think too, one thing that I learned working with Chris on films as a producer is that you don't want to do anything that's negative with the person's logo. So even if McDonald's logo is in the background in Times Square, you probably want to avoid someone being like grotesquely murdered or anything just to be safe.
Well, yeah, that's true because McDonald's lawyers, I mean, even if they don't have a meritorious claim for trademark infringement against you, they could make your life very difficult. Like, you could always sue somebody, even if your claim doesn't necessarily have merit. And you could always write, you know, threatening or harassing letters. And McDonald's has a lot of money, and you don't want their lawyers doing that with you. So, probably from just a practical perspective, it's probably best not to have somebody murdered underneath the McDonald's logo or for the characters to be talking about, no, I never go to McDonald's, their food sucks, or something along those lines. If you do want to claim that your use of a copyrighted image or clip is fair use, then that is something that you are going to have to put in your E&O insurance application. And it may result in a higher premium or the insurer asking you further questions or something like that. So that's something to keep take into account. Thelma just asked, what is E&O insurance? That stands for errors and omissions insurance. So for instance, somebody suing the production company or the distributor for trademark infringement or copyright infringement and other like intellectual property claims, defamation claims, so claims that a documentary made a false statement about somebody, right? That's the kind of thing that would be covered by E&O insurance. Essentially, legal claim is based on the content of the
film. We do have a slight delay on our side, so there's questions coming in that I think you're answering right before their questions are coming in. But Lucky, I would say the answer is always, if you can, get a lawyer. Like, get an entertainment lawyer to make sure that you are doing everything right. He says, do you need a good lawyer to determine the best place to shoot to capitalize on state film credits? That's a little less lawyer and more producers tend to know, really good producers know where you should be filming to get those credits. We have Dominique. Could we potentially work with and secure deals only having a lawyer instead of an agent? Yes. But expand on that, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, an agent is probably going to be helpful in terms of the contacts that they have. I mean, I think that's largely what, at least I would pay an agent a commission for, because there are like distributors who will talk to them and they won't talk to anybody else. They need all the agented submissions. I think that's at least a significant portion of what you're paying for with an agent. If you some agents are also lawyers and some managers are also lawyers. So you may have one of those hybrid people that you can work with. If you happen to find, say, a distributor for your film without the help of an agent or manager, and sometimes that happens, then yeah, I wouldn't say that you need an agent at that point, because the agent's just going to take money off the top without necessarily contributing a lot. Then what you want to do is you want to go to your lawyer and have them read the distribution agreement and make sure that you fulfill all the deliverable requirements that the distributor is going to put on you, which are going to be a lot, by the way, in case you haven't done a distribution of a feature film. We've had a lot of fun dealing with that in the past. And I do that for clients all the time. I now work with a distribution of indie films.
And I know most like professional writers in the studio system don't even have agents anymore after all that drama went down. They have a manager and they have a lawyer, and their lawyer does all the deals and contracts and everything. So no, you do not need an agent, but a good lawyer is worth their money for sure. Lucky says on the tax credit thing, some states have not paid their agreed upon film tax credits, changed governors, changed their bylaws. That's a scary thought to. How can filmmakers protect themselves with that, Chris? If we go film somewhere and we're expecting that credit, and then something changes, Is there a way to, like, are we legally, like, we have to get that credit now? They promised it to us. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it would involve looking at it on a case-by-case basis in terms of what you were promised and what wasn't delivered and so on. But yeah, I mean, the fact that it was the government offering you the credit, if they specifically signed an agreement with you saying that you were going to receive it and then they don't give it to you, well, then yeah, it is still possible to sue under those circumstances. But yeah, again, it all is a matter of what you were told and what was not delivered and so forth. And so you'd need to talk to a lawyer about what your options are if you're in that situation.
Are there any legal considerations a client should have prior to shopping our series to studios and networks?
I would make sure that if you're going to share an idea with a studio or a network or a story or something like that, make sure that you understand that your story idea is not necessarily going to be protected by copyright. Because copyright doesn't protect ideas, generally speaking. It only protects what's known as the expression of those ideas. So it doesn't protect the idea of a giant lizard monster destroying Tokyo, but it protects the specific script for Godzilla. No one can go and use the script for Godzilla because of the copyright protection. So it's important to keep that in mind.
There's a couple of things to consider. One, obviously, you have to have an agent or a lawyer for the most part. They're going to have to submit your work. You cannot submit your work yourself. Most studios will not take that. So I would say if you're going to get an entertainment lawyer and you're trying to submit to studios, you need to have a lawyer. You're going to have to pay bigger fees because you're going to need a lawyer who has those contacts and who's willing to help you that way. That's usually why somebody has an agent. It's to open those doors. If you have a manager who can open the doors, and still your lawyer needs to submit the script so that there's some kind of paper trail. And that doesn't just protect you. Those studios want that. They want to be protected themselves.
One thing I would add, actually, on Dominique's question, the studios will probably have you sign a form specifically saying that you're going to waive your rights relating to any IP that you submit to them. And it's not necessarily because they want to steal your IP, but it's because they want to make sure that they're not sued for non-meritorious reasons in the future. If they happen to produce a hit show that's similar in some way to what you submitted to them, then you can't come back and demand millions of dollars.
And I will also tell you, the studios are not going to sign your NDA. I know a lot of new filmmakers think they even would submit to my production company, sign the NDA first. No one's signing your NDA to read your script. I'm sorry. They're just not going to do it. I mean, there's some people who will do it, but for the most part, if you even ask for it, you kind of appear like a green filmmaker. So again, just have your lawyer submit everything so that there's that paper trail. It looks like, although I know we have a little delay, so I'm trying to stall, it looks like that might be the last question that's come up. We're going to try to do this every month, y'all. If it continues to be something everybody wants to come and ask questions for, we're going to spend a half hour every month just trying to answer questions. And then when FilmTracks is live, do you have a date when you're trying to get it live by, Chris? Since we're not lawyers, is it a good idea to have a second lawyer review the original lawyer's advice?
Generally, if you've vetted your lawyer, if you've had a conversation with them where you've established in your mind that they have a good understanding of what you're asking them to do, I would say that's usually not necessary. Like even in terms of a giant corporation, even in, Sony or Disney or something like that wouldn't normally get a second set of sort of check lawyers to look at the contracts that were drafted by their initial ones. So it's more of a matter of making sure you've done your due diligence and had that initial call with the lawyer. If they're going to charge you for the initial call, that's a red flag, by the way. They should do a free initial call with you where they convince you that they have the knowledge that's necessary to handle what you're talking about.
On the lawyer thing, one, I tell you guys this on every podcast that we do. Trust your gut. If you're talking to someone and something feels off, something is off. It doesn't matter how much you like them or how nice they seem to be. Go a different direction. Also, talk to people they've worked with. Like, find out someone else. Like, get referred by other filmmakers who have worked with lawyers. Like, I trust Chris completely. So if you were like, whose entertainment lawyer I should go to, it's Chris. And if you specifically ask me for a certain type of project you need to do, and maybe I would say, maybe Chris isn't your guy. I'm always going to be honest about that. Ask your fellow filmmakers so that you know that you haven't been screwed. That doesn't have anything in this business. Sales agents, distributors, everybody. So that final question, which is a great question, is from David. Should I expect a retainer for services when bringing a lawyer on board, or is it billable hours? How does that usually work? And also, I know lawyers who do a percentage based on, just like an agent would, based on the project.
It really is a matter of individual lawyer. The more work you're expecting the lawyer to do in terms of hours, I think the more likely a retainer is going to be expected. If I'm just going to draft a really short sort of pro forma contract that I've done many times, there's no way that I would require a retainer for that, which is going to take, you know, a couple of hours. If it was a project where I could expect to be working 100 hours in the first month, then I would be more interested in making sure that the client can pay something when the time comes.
Thank you guys for attending our first Ask a Lawyer session. You can check out a ton of cool videos by Chris. Go to YouTube and just type in Film Tracks, FilmTracts. That's his channel on YouTube. And he's got a bunch of videos on all kinds of things. He's always putting more. I subscribe. So follow him on the socials as well. And thank you all.
Thanks for listening to the Working Director Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, please rate and review, as it helps others find the show and helps us keep making great content for you. And if you want even more help with your directing career, check out theworkingdirector.pro, where you can apply to be part of the accelerator that hones in on where you currently are and helps you get to where you want to be. Whether it's this podcast, the accelerator, or our free Facebook community for directors, we're here to help you get to work.